You might want to have that checked. By the way, beautiful picture of your dog is on your QIZ site. Is your dog's name Patty Cake? That's what it seems to be saying on his label that's in front of him. Over to you, Eric.
No, not really. I threw that picture in there just as a placeholder. The same thing with the bio. I threw a resume on there. Again, it's more like a bookmark. I'd like to replace that with when I have the time and inclination with some type of profile that, chronicles, a 60-year-old entering the hobby, my experience. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Eric. I recommend you add about 2 or 3 more inches of spacing between you and that microphone until you get a chance to correct that very hot audio you've got. Good, clean audio, but very hot. Okay, I think we've gone down the list, except for Rich, into EO. Oh, yeah, as you can tell, we went way far left and right of center, Joe, but it looks like there is some question about, do the photovoltaics, do they have a whole lot of reliability beyond 5 years? If you do a calculation and for your particular circumstance, you're going to get 10 years return on investment. It is a little bit questionable. W2RYY, the guy who asked the original question, K2RYW. Hope he didn't put you to sleep, Joe. Maybe Joe is no longer there. Rich, N2EO, what would you like to know about grounding your antenna from lightning?
Okay, Dick. Good evening, N2EO. I put up a Glenn Martin roof tower 10 foot high on the peak of the roof. Actually, Barry N2MB was kind enough to put it up for me last year at the end of the season, the lightning season, that is. I did some grounding. What Barry had done was ran, I got the copper wire, I think it's number 4 and number 6, I forget, but I got it from Glenn Martin Engineering, who makes the tower, and it's expressly intended for lightning grounding, so I don't remember the gauge. It's more than 1/4 inch thick, I can tell you that. He draped it down the corners of the house, and had an electrician come in and drive rods, 2 rods in the front, 2 rods in the back with a Hilti. He ran conduit up the side of the house to put the ground wires through the conduit. And I want to expand that ground system, Dick. What I've done over the winter, I installed bus bar, which I got from AES, behind all the equipment. All the equipment is tied individually to that bus bar. The only Achilles here, let me let it reset. I've got the bus bar grounded to the water pipe. Now what I want to do is have the water pipe tied to the ground rods by an electrician. Have them go through the foundation, run a wire, and bond everything together. I wonder if you think that's sufficient. Maybe there were some mistakes I made or some things can be improved. The coax comes down the wall from the attic. It goes through a vent. What we're going to do, me and Barry, is ground coax shield at the tower. Downstairs in the basement, I've got 3 Alpha Delta lightning suppressors, which, the ARC cartridges, which are commercial quality. They're rated for cellular industry and that sort of thing. And the shields will be grounded there. And then the shields will be grounded in the third place where they go through a plate on the wall right below the equipment. Now, I'm here to reset. All right, N2EO. I've also got an air gap on the tower, which I got from Glenn Martin. It's about an 18-inch high air gap at the very tippy top. That is grounded to the tower. And a couple of things. They sell a taller air gap. I wonder if there's any point to that, or if I'm inviting lightning by putting a taller air gap, or it's a good thing to do. What else? I'm trying to think. I also, by the way, I understand you're supposed to ground the tower in all four corners of the dwelling. See, I can't do that. It's a semi-attached house. My neighbor owns one half, I own the other half. So it's grounded in two corners. Now, I thought of maybe having him add some more ground rods and, like I say, tie it to the plumbing. I wonder what your thoughts are, Dick. K2RIW N2EL.
Wow. Rich, you are a belt and suspenders and a hand on the belt man. Wow. When it comes to the amount of lightning grounding you've done, you're way ahead of 99% of all the hams we can talk to. Way ahead. You've done a lot more, and you want to know, should you do more? Because that shiny piece of Glenn Martin Tower and that shiny new antenna you put up there is something very valuable to you. Your eye sees it. To you, it looks like it's very high above the ground, and you're positive that it is attracting every lightning bolt on the east coast of the United States. If you really look realistically at your environment, if you're a lightning bolt looking down on Whitestone and looking at your environment, you've got a tremendous great big grid of Con Ed wires running all over the place. You've got water towers, you've got buildings, you've got trees, you've got all kinds of things. You've got a zillion targets right in your town, right on your block. The chances of a lightning bolt striking your particular structure is very, very slim. What are we going to say about that? Have you had a bunch of lightning strikes already, Rich? Is that what you're about to tell me?
Yes, I had one about 6-7 years ago. I didn't have the tower. I had a vertical up on the roof, and it did take a direct hit. My neighbor saw the flash. It was a fiberglass antenna that was cut in two, half wound up in the neighbor's tree about 50 feet away. And you could see the end of the fiberglass looked like a whisk broom. It was all discolored black and shredded. And the only damage I had was to the coax selector switch on the antenna tuner.
Maybe you've got an unusual environment. The farm that my grandfather used to have in Glen Cove on top of a hill was such that every lightning storm would give them some grief. And about once per year, the lightning would strike one of their barns and catch it on fire. And my grandmother, as such, developed an extreme fear of lightning. And every time a thunderstorm came along, she would go into a shock mode, so to speak. So they had a very unusual environment, and something about that particular layout of the land, lightning struck it a lot. And they never had any lightning rods installed in any of the buildings. They didn't know about that. Now, this is the early 1900s when this all took place on my grandfather's farm. So maybe where you live in Whitestone just happens to be one of those chunks of land. When Barry is standing on your roof or standing on your Glen Martin Tower and he looks at the horizon, what do you believe he sees? Does he see anything at your altitude? Hills, trees, buildings, water towers? What do you think he sees? Is yours the highest structure for a mile around? Over to you, Rich, K2RIW.
B0YTN. BC2QAQ with a comment.
Okay, Dick, I am the highest thing around. The houses are all the same height on the street. There was just a development. There's a school across the street that's slightly higher than the houses, and I'm higher than it. I can even see, I know when I used to go up there before I got sick, I could see North Shore Towers from my roof. You can see the bank building in Brooklyn. You can see the Empire State Building. You can see the tops of the Throgneck Bridge. It's a clear shot all the way around, which is great for VHF. I've got 6.2 and 4.32 up there, but, you know, it's a two-edged sword.
Yeah, from the top of my 100-foot tower, I can count. It used to be 51. Now it's 49 buildings in Manhattan. I can see North Shore Towers. I can see the. I can watch aircraft landing at Kennedy Airport. I see Nassau County Medical Center. I see an awful lot of things. From my point of view, I'm the tallest thing around. And you would think I've got 100 foot of tower on nearly 300 foot above sea level land. So the top of my tower is 400 feet above sea level. And I'm the tallest thing around. I can watch, I can look into Connecticut, I can look over the Long Island Sound, I see Great South Bay, Fire Island, Atlantic Ocean, and so on. You would think I'd be struck all the time. I've been here since 1969, what is that, 41 years, and a nearby lightning strike occurred once. A direct strike on the tower, never, to my knowledge. A direct strike, you know, significant strike. Well, there was one kind of a flash that happened in the wintertime in a snowstorm once, so it's hard to judge. There was a W0, there was a zero something or other, a guy who's just signed it, slowly give me your full call letters, your name, and then your comment, sir. And then we'll pick up our Glenn in that order. The zero first, go ahead.
KB0YTU, first personal was Neil, operating region 2 portable. Just a comment on the electric code. Why don't you just get a copy of the latest national electric code and go to the RF to the communications section, and it gives you complete instructions on what to do and how to ground. It sounds like you're just going overkill on this on your grounding. That's just my comment. Back to the net.
Yeah, but Rich has the resources, and if it's an overkill and it doesn't cost him a whole lot of money, he's going to do it. I don't blame him. Let's see what Glenn's going to say on this one. KC2QI2, K2LIW.
Yeah, Dick, I just want to make a couple of comments. Most of the guidelines that I follow most of this time are the ones from the IEC. They have a whole document. I think I might have forwarded it over to you once on grounding shelters. And one thing that's really expressed very heavily in those documents is that the items that have the tendency of getting struck the worst are items where you have metal charge in the air. In other words, a piece of metal that's not connected to ground. In other words, if it floats up in the air and there's no place to discharge, in other words, lightning just generally doesn't come as one quick flash, you know, like a flash in the pan. It actually builds up over time. And as that charge builds up, the voltage on the end builds up to a level, and then eventually it arcs and discharges. So the idea is that if you keep the antennas on the outside of the house grounded very, very well, you don't allow that charge to build up on the antenna. And this way your chances of preventing that arc over taking place are, greatly reduced. Let me let it drop for a second.
And I'm pretty sure his air gap is also bleeding off charge. Go ahead, Glenn.
And the other thing that they mentioned very heavily, too, there, is that as far as lightning grounding inside the shelter or inside your shack, that they really don't advise a lot of running, your equipment to ground rods inside the house. The idea there is that, you don't want to create the path of discharge through the inside of your living area. In other words, you want your areas of discharge to be on the outside. So if the antennas are outside, you want to run those grounding wires, to the ground outside away from the living area of your shelter. So the kind of grounding that you want to run inside the shack would be your safety ground first, going back to the safety ground on your utility power box. So that's the green-yellow wire or the center pin on your power connector. That's just to basically prevent electrical shock, but not lightning protection. The other grounding, of course, is your RF interconnections between your transceiver and your amplifier. So you basically have three grounding systems you want to run. One is your safety ground inside the house for electrical safety inside, your RF ground between your equipment, but your lightning protection and your ground rod should really be done all outside the house, trying to prevent any discharge through your cables back into the house. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Pick out there, Dick.
I was going to pick up Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Glenn kind of covered it. Basically, what I was going to say is that you can build up charges across the antenna. One day I was putting up a 2-meter beam, and, it's not thundering yet, but you can draw a good arc off the collapse. But, up at the World Trade Center, we used to get whacked all the time. And with adequate grounding, you don't wind up with any equipment failures. But it is important that before the point of entry into the house is that you have some kind of a gas discharge device if you're really concerned about your gear. There's a lot of different manufacturers, and all the commercial communication equipment uses them, and for the most part, it works pretty well. But there is the problem of when you get a strike and you get an EMP pulse, it, they can do nasty things to the gear, but Grant kind of covered it. K2RIWK, 3 guys.
K1.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, very simply put, I've got a tower here that's 85 feet tall. It is the tallest thing in the area, and it's right along the coast. It has been struck a number of times by lightning. What I have done is I have on top of there's a pipe that the mast extends up the top, above the top beam, that approximately about 8 feet. That's part of the strut support for the big beam, for the boom that's 36 feet long. So it has the struts come off that. However, right on the top of the center of the pipe, I have a pin. It's a steel pin sharpened to a very sharp point. It's called a desensitizing system, what they same way they do it on many buildings. They have these sharp pins along the periphery of the building grounded to the cable, which goes to the ground system. Now let me let it drop, and I'll say something about the ham shack. Okay, I never leave the cable connected from any of my antennas to any of the equipment. As it enters the house, I tear the cables, the ground, the antenna cables go directly to a panel that is a brute force ground. In other words, no switches or anything. This way, I can't have any possibility of any equipment being left connected in case of any lightning situation. The tower itself is a whole series of ground rods that have sunk all around the property here, all joined together with number six wire that's brazed to each one of the rods. That's a whole grid of them. And that's basically my system. Also, when I break the AC in the house, in the Radio Shack, I pull the switch. It breaks both the neutral and the 2110s, Dick, over.
Wow. The 2110s and the neutral. The return, in other words. Now, the fourth lead, the guard wire, you're running 220 in the shack, I take it. The guard wire still stays. But I had the impression now from what Glenn and others are saying that all the lightning arresting, grounding, bypassing, and whatever, if at all possible, it should be external to the living quarters. That none of your lightning protection systems, other than your disconnecting cables in the shack, all of your real lightning protection is external to your living quarters. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
Well, as the cables come in, when not in use, they are onto a panel that's grounded. The panel is just SO239 connected. I just put the cables onto that, and that's and they're shorted. In other words, the connector, center pin of the connector, is connected, shorted to the panel. And this panel goes down as part of the outside grounding system. And also in the shack, when the switch is pulled, it is not only opening the 220 and the 110 lines, but it's grounding it. It's grounding everything together. In other words, you got no connection whatsoever to the equipment, and there is no way that any electric could really enter any part of the system, because the panel itself, the breaker panel, is connected to the ground rod system. Take over.
I think I understand that, and I see why you're doing that, but you also said that the SO239 connectors on that grounded panel that enters the shack, that you short the center conductors of those cables to ground. Does that mean you put a grounding plug on each one of those when you disconnect the cable? Over to you, Mel.
Let me explain what the panel is. As it is, it's right by the window. Well, actually, where it comes through the wall, the cables are all ported through the wall. This panel is a piece of aluminum panel that's about a quarter inch thick. I have mounted on it a bunch of SO239 connectors. These connectors are mounted to the panel, you know, screwed to the panel normally, and I took the center pin of the connector, and I put that also to the panel. And the panel now has a ground line that goes outside, a heavy cable that goes down to the ground rod. Now, so when you put the cable on and screw that cable, the coax cable, to those SO239, the sensor pin and the shield is now shorted essentially to that aluminum panel, Dick, over.
Okay, what is connecting the center pin of your SO239, which is the center of the coax cable going outside the shack up to the antenna? What is creating that short circuit between that center pin and either the outer shell of the SO239 or the quarter-inch thick piece of aluminum, which is itself grounded? I'm having trouble picturing what is grounding that center pin when you're in the protected mode. Go ahead, Mel.
I'll try to explain it. I took SO239 and mounted them on this aluminum panel. I took the center pin. Of course, the shell of it is already mounted to the panel. I took the center pin. I ran a short piece of, a heavy piece of wire, like number 10 wire from the pin in the back of the SO239 chassis connector, and put that right to the panel, right to one of the screws. In other words, essentially shorting out the SO239 to the panel, and the panel, like I say, goes down to the ground. So when you screw your cable on, the antenna cables that are coming in, when I screw it onto this panel, it's shorting the PL259 of the coax cable to this panel directly, both the sensor pin and the shell together, over.
If the center pin is being shorted to ground, when the coax cable is connected, when you want to go to the active mode and transmit RF energy through that shorted pin, how do you unshort it so that the RF energy can get to the antenna? Go ahead.
Upper panel, Dick.
Oh, you've got a grounding panel only used during lightning effects, and another panel is used for real RF energy effects. And you do that on both the cables on the outside of the house and the cables. Yeah, you do the cables on the outside of the house, if I get the impression, get moved over to these bunch of shorting plugs on that panel. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
Exactly, and then I take the appropriate antenna cable that I want, I take it off this panel, and I put it to the rig, whichever one, rigs I want to use. It does two things. First of all, I make sure that only one antenna to that one rig at any time. This way, I can't have any possibility of two radios being connected to the antenna system at the same time, and all of a sudden they make a mistake and transmit from one radio by mistake into another one. So another big amplifier could do a heck of a job on a radio. So this way, all the antennas coming in that are not being used, the cables are not being used, they're onto this grounding panel. You take off the appropriate cable that you want to use, whichever antenna, put it then to your equipment, to your regular connector to your equipment, Dick, over.
Zero ICU.
To the shack. Now, if the cable on the outside of the house going to the antenna is going to the grounded SO239s, and when you want to be active, they're moved over to one that is ungrounded, how do you reach around to the back end of the panel to the outside of the house to move that cable? Over to you, Mel.
B0 ITU.
Okay, well, picture the cable. No, the panel's not outside. It's inside. It's right at the port where the cables enter the house. Picture the cables all coming into the radio shack. They have PL259s on them. There sits up against the port, by the port there, right adjacent to the port, is this panel. This quarter-inch piece of aluminum with the SO239s that are shorted together in the back with the ground strap. And all the cables now just come in and loop around and screw onto this panel, Dick. So then when you want to use it, you don't have to reach outside. It's inside the shack. You just unscrew it from inside from that panel and then move it over. In other words, the cables are looped inside, over.
I've got the picture now. Let's see what Neil's got to add to this. KB0YTU, K2RIW. Go ahead, Neil. My name is Dick.
Thank you. KB0YTU, operating region 2, portable. It sounds like you're just giving another path for lightning a path for lightning inside your shack. It doesn't sound good. It just it just doesn't sound good. I mean, if you get if you get a direct strike and you have all these coax going to ground, some of the lightning strike is gonna drain off into, of course, one of the paths of least resistance, and that panel may be across your room. So I'd rethink this. I would seriously rethink this. Now, of course, I'm approaching this as a Midwesterner, I guess you can say, as we do have some lightning problems out there. Back to the net.
It doesn't go across the room. It's right at the entrance where the cables come into the house.
No, I meant when the lightning strikes it and it wants to blow it across the room, back to the net.
Well, that's why I have up on the tower. But chances are, this is only secondary. On top of the tower, that desensitizing pin usually takes the brunt of the lightning.
That cable that comes from the outside world entering the area of your shack, Mel, I'm getting the impression that there's very little cable from the outside world into the shack, into that grounded panel, and that's as close as you can get to an outside wall, so to speak. What I think Neil is concerned about is that there is enough length of cable in the shack, and the grounding takes place from the shack back to a cable going outdoors, a six-gauge wire or whatever. The fact that the cable is grounded in the shack as opposed to external to the living quarters seems to be what's giving Neil some grief. You might want to give us a little bit more explanation on that one, Mel. Go ahead, Mel.
Now, the cable that comes in through the port in the wall is very short. It's only about maybe a foot and a half of cable, because what I do is when I take it off that grounding panel, I move it to the other panel, which is adjacent to it, about a foot and a half over to the other side, and that's what I screw onto. That's the panel that routes the cables to all the different radios in the shack. So now I just screw it onto that, and that's what the routing of it to the different radios. But this is just a secondary, because I think most of the protection, that's just in case something can come down those coax, which is very unlikely, because the grounding pin up on top of the tower, on top of that 8-foot mast, on top of the 85-foot tower, that pin takes the brunt of it. The spark really goes to that. This is just residual situation, Dick, over.
QAQ.
Glenn recognized, but first, Neil, you live in Minneapolis. From your point of view, is lightning characteristics in Minneapolis, where you live, a fairly serious problem? Do a lot of the guys there have to do heroic things to make sure that the nearest lake, I'm trying to figure out which lake it is, probably Lake Michigan, doesn't give you grief? A couple of words on that one, Neil, go ahead.
I think you had some other guys in there, but very quickly, we have some extremely serious thunderstorms, lightning strikes, and we do have tornadoes, and probably the best protection guys with towers have is to just physically disconnect the coax and let it dangle, and to adequately ground the tower, bond it to the electric system, bond your grounding system together, and that should do it. I think with all due respect, I mean, I think what this gentleman is doing is just a bit overkill, and actual physical disconnection is the only true way to protect any strike from entering your ham shack. Back to the net.
Okay, thank you for the information, Neil. Glenn, you used to live in the lightning capital of the United States, Florida, and I think you were not that far from Gainesville. So you've seen a lot of lightning, and you've lived through it. So give us a few words on that. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, I guess one of the differences that I would do from what Mel is saying is one of the practices that I've learned is I use a very, very similar plate as a feed-through at the where my feed lines come into the house. And I do ground that plate into a ground rod outside the house into the ground, separate from the grounds from the direct antenna masts and towers that I have here. But the key difference there is that in that aluminum diamond plate that I'm using as my feed-through, I just have feed-throughs going through it. So basically the coaxial cables are terminated to ground at the side of the house before entry. And there again, that's just a belt and suspenders really at that point in time, and it keeps the keeps everything grounded before it enters the living area. The other thing I wanted to point out was that rotators on towers can be a problem. Let me let it drop for a second. One of the things I've done with rotators is to take a ground strap or a ground wire along with the loop of coax that goes from the top mast to the bottom of the rotator base, is to basically put a ground jumper from that top mast down to the bottom half, because you can get some resistance problems between the top half of the rotator to the bottom half. That can cause some issues. The other thing, too, is that if you have towers that are made of steel that have kind of like gotten old, you can have connection problems on their way down. So sometimes it's also an important thing to do is to make sure that the bolts and everything that you have are making good grounding connections on each layer of the tower, and that if you really want to do belt and suspenders, if you're in a real nasty lightning area like Florida, where that's located, you actually might want to put jumpers from each tower leg to the next tower leg to make sure that you've got those connections there, to make sure that that charge is always being bled off, and that there's no chance of allowing the a piece of metal up in the air to build up any charge deck. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
As you can see, Rich, there's lots of ways of doing it. If you haven't already done so, I'd strongly recommend you go to the Polyphaser company, because they make all kinds of fancy lightning arresters, and I hope they still produce this book on lightning techniques. Oh, 10 years ago when I bought the book from them, it was $20, a very good investment. It's an 8.5x11 format. Always, I remember, it was about a 50-page book, white front cover, lightning protection techniques or something like that. But the Polyphaser website and the Polyphaser company and a phone call to them is going to get you a copy of this book. And when you read it, it's going to give you a lot of information that I think is going to be helpful, because they've been in the business for 20, 30, 40 years and protecting some really healthy industrial and broadcast and whatever sites. So I do recommend you get a hold of that book, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, 2RIW, TechNet, Limelock, N2EO. I will go online this evening and see if I can order that book. I think you mentioned that once before, but what Mel Glenn said, it's already been done. The air gap on the top has wire coming down. That's on the rotating mast. It loops around with the coax, grounds to the tower, and then off the tower there are two ground wires, one to the back of the house, one to the front of the house. They go down the side of the house with conduit, and each one has two 10-foot rods. My only concern is what was said. I'm going to reset. See, the way the coax are dressed down, they go through the wall, and they come out in a hung ceiling, and then they go out a sheetrock wall in the basement. I'm going to put a plate in like what Mel said. I thought of that. But I wonder if I'm buying trouble with that coax up in the ceiling. There's really no, I guess it could be done another way, but it'll be a real pain in the shoes at this time to move it. It's grounded at the tower. It's going to be grounded in the ceiling, the shield, an arc suppressor on there, and then grounded at the plate. And by the way, Dick, this is not HF where I can just haphazardly run connectors. Everything has to be done on bulkhead type ends. I'm running small signal work on 2, 432, 6 meters, and soon to be 1296. So that's the story. What I'd like to know, the air gap that I have is about an 18-inch gap. is there any advantage or disadvantage to putting a taller air gap up? Is it a better thing to do? Does it not matter? Or is, am I buying trouble? They sell a 6-foot gap, Glenn Martin Engineering. Back to Ned and to Rio.
You got an opinion on that one, Glenn?
Well, I do have an opinion, but here again, it's for what it's worth, and this is my experience would tell me that the air gaps, especially in a home location, I wouldn't go with them. But what I do prefer in its place is a porcupine. And I don't know if you've ever seen these before, but you can actually make them yourself. It's basically just a bunch of elements that are hanging off of your grounded part of your tower or your mast. That's at the tallest part. So what you're basically doing is you're kind of like making a big static ball up on the top and make sure that everything is grounded really, really well all the way to the bottom. And what that basically does is it accumulates charge, and it basically just makes sure that that charge is current and going into the ground. And it basically builds any kind of charge voltage from building up onto any of your equipment. And if that's working properly, the good old porcupine gathering all that charge and dissipating it into currents running into the ground, I don't think you'll ever, ever, ever have a discharge problem. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
By the way, Dick, I checked it. I had run the Con Ed hot over to the light bulb, hit it and touched the bulb to neutral in the bulb light.
You did that to prove to yourself that your grounding system is very effective. Is that what you're saying, Rich?
Absolutely, Dick. I wanted to make sure that you know, a 60-watt bulb, which is what I have, that's what I use, 60-watt bulbs, lit to what looked like full brilliance. So, is there any advantage to adding more ground, either ground wires or adding to the existing wires more ground rods? I guess it's an opinion. You really don't know until you get hit. I wanted to have the electrician come in and tie everything together, the ground rod to the plumbing system. The plumbing system has already the safety ground on it for Con Edison. And the reason for the bus bar, I figured if I should get a hit when everything is connected, I'll try and disconnect. But, you know, the one time you don't disconnect, that's the time you get hit. My thought was to have everything bonded together so if there is a charge on there, everything rises and falls at the same potential. No potential difference, no current flow from different chassis. Back to you, Dick.
Does anybody within the sound of my voice have an opinion on the question that Rich just asked? Should he add more ground rods than he's already got? Should he tie them all together in some elaborate way? Give me a call, letters, if you got an opinion. I heard Glenn, and who was the other person?
Bruce, yeah.
Glenn. Okay, I'm hearing a bunch of doubles. Glenn, go ahead.
Rich, my best advice for you is that anything inside the shack, you really don't want it to look like lightning ground. If you're going to do any additional grounding, it's really on the outside of the house. As far as the key things to grounding outside the house are the depth of your ground rods. The deeper they are and the wetter the soil is, the better the ground they are. I think where you're located right now, if you've got 10-foot rods, 8 to 10-foot rods, and you said you've already got 4 of them inside there, and they're relatively into moist ground, I think you're really, really set. I think you're in pretty good shape. The advantage of adding more of them, I don't think it's going to do you a whole heck of a lot more good. At that point in time, there was you're really just interested in bleeding off charge and preventing it from building up. But the one thing that worries me a lot is that when people think that inside the shack, by adding more and more grounds inside to earth ground, in other words, not grounds to the utility, but in other words, grounds to earth ground inside your shack, you're really inviting the lightning inside your house. The key thing with grounding inside the shack is really your safety ground back to your utility. If that's a good ground, that's all you ground to, your third pin plug or, you know, from the case of your radios. That should be more than enough. Additional grounds would be your RF grounds. In other words, between your amplifier, your transceivers, and any equipment along your desk, ground them together. But that's really for RF reasons. That wouldn't be for lightning. You know, the key thing is lightning protection. You really want that all to be your current paths for lightning on the outside of the structure. And, you know, there again, if you really, really, really want to be sure, do like Mel does, disconnect the feed lines coming into the house so that you have no path for lightning to come into the shack. And that would be the best you can do. That would be superior to grounding. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, I heard it double that time, but one of them was Westley. Go ahead, Westley.
And so, Jim, one of the things that you didn't mention that actually stands against grounding everything together is step voltage. When you have a high voltage line falling down on the ground, and then you make a step, the difference between first and second legs quite be much significant and make it. Now, if we have a situation where everything is grounded, we have a step voltage as well. So the difference of the potential between everything grounded is very much dangerous. My suggestion is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that a transceiver should never be grounded. And to exchange.
Easier Jake. Go ahead, Eric.
I just want to make one point. You know, I have that 300-foot tower in Plainview, and one of the most important things about the grounding of that tower, don't forget that whole tower is at ground potential, I've got six 30-foot rods that are as close to the base of that tower as possible. And the grounding system, even though we use, you know, a 6- and 8-inch wide copper plating and braid, it has resistance. So once you start distributing ground, you get differences of potential, especially when you have, you know, that amount of energy flowing through. We get hit all the time, so. But because the ground system is the way it is, the damage is so minimal. But, you know, my coax is 6-inch coax, which is pretty hefty stuff, so the stuff that's coming down the outside winds up in the ground, doesn't wind up in the transmitter. K2RIW, K2J.
If I understand you correctly, you've got 30-foot ground rods, is what I think you said. Does that mean that each grounding rod goes down 30 feet into the soil, is question number one. Question number two, how many of them? And number three, you get hit quite often. You've been in that transmitter room at times when the antenna was struck. Do you sense, do you hear anything? Over to you, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. They're six rods, and they're 30 feet long. And every now and then, I dump a little salt water down them. They do corrode. They oxidize a little bit. And they recommend that you wear them once in a blue moon. And, yeah, I've been there when it's hit. And you see a flash of light, and you don't hear anything for about 5 minutes afterwards because it's really loud.
You see a flash of light, which I guess is the lightning striking the top of the tower. Since you're not hearing anything, I guess it's a pretty loud sound. I presume the sound you're hearing is coming from the lightning bolt striking the top of the tower 300 feet above you. I'd like to believe that none of that sound is happening inside of the transmitting room itself. Is that approximately true, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, you actually feel the compression. It's sort of like there's a little vacuum that's right around you. You feel it. It's loud. It takes you see the flash and then you feel it. I suppose it's only milliseconds of delay, but there is an actual physical effect. And the walls of the place shake a little bit.
Okay. Comments?
I'm now recognized, but one further question, Eric. On the worst case year, how many of those lightning strikes did you personally experience in 1 year? Over to you, Eric.
All right. In Plainview, it's not that often. It happens maybe two or three times in the summer while you're physically there. But at the top of the World Trade Center, that's a whole other story. But the interesting thing is the World Trade Center, it gets whacked. There's just so much isolation from inside the building. As far as Empire goes, I've never been at Empire when it's been whacked, so I couldn't tell you what happened there.
On the worst case day at World Trade Center, or worst case year, how many strikes in what period of time do you think World Trade has sustained on the worst case year? Eric, go ahead.
Well, I honestly have to say that it's hundreds of times during the summer. Hundreds. That thing gets whacked all the time, or it did get whacked all the time. You can actually point the camera at the building and make some really nice photographs.
On the worst case storm you have ever experienced, how frequent were the lightning strikes at World Trade during that storm? Over to you, Eric.
It doesn't necessarily take a storm. Don't forget that you're inside the clouds in that building. The clouds are actually below you, and sometimes the lightning goes up. I don't know. Again, it's really hard to know in terms of when you're inside the building. From the outside, you can count them.
In other words, during one particular lightning storm, you may have been hit five times. Would that be a approximation for a really bad storm? And some of those are up lightning strikes?
Yeah, and it's got to be more than five times. I mean, on a interesting night, I think we were over at, we were at Empire, actually, looking up, because we were doing some microwave work. I pointed the camera out there. Opened the lens, opened the shutter for, I think, about 6 or 8 minutes, and we could count, I think there was something like 15 strikes in that picture.
No, those 15 strikes, were they grouped in any way? Almost every one of them is hitting the top of that mast, and I think your mast was roughly 200 feet high above the top floor of the building. Go ahead.
Yeah, in that picture, it's mostly at the top, but there were some strikes that actually hit the antennas on the side. That mast actually is a big radome, but down about the 100-foot level where the standby antennas are, and they're also at ground potential. Those things have gotten whacked a number of times, too.
Any electronic damage ever occur from any of these strikes at World Trade?
It happens occasionally, but very rarely.
And what kind of damage are we talking about here, Eric? Go ahead.
Sometimes I lose an output module. And in the output module, you probably lose a couple of... Now, this is at Channel 13. It moves maybe four MRF-151s, that's it.
KC2, QIQ.
Glenn recognized, during that loss, that decreases one quarter of your power or something like that when you lose a module. Are you still on the air, Eric? Go ahead.
No, each module is 1,500 watts. The total output of the transmitter was 30 kilowatts, so no, you barely notice.
Interesting. Okay. We've got Mel and Glenn in that order. Mel, go ahead.
Okay. Well, first of all, when the power was struck here, I heard the tower actually ring. It sounded like a big snap and a ring and then bang. And it was, I'm telling you, it shook this house, really shook this house. But as Glenn says, that porcupine that I have on top of the tower, I think is really what they call a desensitizer. I see also a number of buildings also have these rods around the edge with this strap, a cable connecting all those rods down to ground. Now, my one ground system I have here, I have a well in the backyard. Now, when I was putting down that well, which is a 36-foot pipe that goes down and driven into the ground, I welded all the joints as I was going down. I just made sure I put a weld across all the couplings as it went down. And I'm grounded to that and to six rods. Now, when you get down here with a ground rod here, 6, 8, 9 feet. You're into the water table here, the first beginning, because I'm only 350 feet off the Atlantic Ocean. So this is basically my ground system here, and like I say, I've been hit a couple times here, Dick, and no damage whatsoever. But let me let it drop. I'll say one more thing about the shack. I think they're very important about the AC coming in the shack, about lightning sneaking in through the AC lines. constantly hear about people who have electronics blown out, and it's, you know, it's creeping in through the AC line. So it's very important that I break those connections in the Radio Shack, completely break them, and ground, and the box at that point for the neutral, of course, is, you know, the conduit for the neutral, that is grounded also there, so that it makes sure that AC, that it can't creep in through the AC line, stick over.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with that one 100%. I've been here 41 years. I've sustained one real lightning strike that I'm not sure hit the tower. I'm reasonably sure it hit the 110-volt line within a couple of blocks of my house, because me and all the adjacent neighbors suffered 110-volt amp damage, you know, refrigerators, air conditioners, computers, and things like that. In my house, it was television set, computer. None of the ham radio equipment was touched. But everything connected to the 110-volt line on the other end of the house from the shack experienced a fair amount of grief. Refrigerator, no damage, but TV set, computers, modulator, demodulator to the computer, you know, everything that connected to the outside world, to the internet. So I'm reasonably sure that in my case it crawled into the 110-volt line. And the tower itself, with its grounding, seemed to not know about it, per se. KC2QIQ, go ahead, Glenn. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Just a couple of quick comments. One thing about power line type of problems, if you have a particular item inside your house or an area or a room or some piece of equipment that's very, very sensitive to things in the power line, one easy way of bypassing that is using an isolation transformer, if you can get one available or pick one up. The isolation transformer basically, you know, isolates the power line, so if there is any kind of, like, you know, common mode type of problem there, that will break the path for it. It could save the equipment that in a problem area. Other things are, you know, going back to the porcupine accumulators, on very, very tall towers or tall structures, one of the things that makes those porcupine accumulators so effective is that if you've got a single piece of pipe up in a very, very high altitude, what will happen is even though the tower itself is grounded, you've got a proximity issue between the air within just a couple of feet of the tower itself, where you can get arcing and breaking down between the air and the tower itself. So it's really not striking the tower. What's happening is you're getting an air breakdown in an air gap between, like a corona breakdown between the tower and the fast-moving air. So if you have the accumulator porcupines reaching out quite a few feet from the tower in multiple areas, it disperses that charge area in between and starts breaking it down and leaving those currents into the tower and start discharging them before you get any arcs a few feet from the tower. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
KB2IQN with a comment.
IQN, go ahead.
The light event at
KB2IQN. His name is Chris. He's got the same last name as I do, K2RIW. He's on his way upstate, and unfortunately, he's out of range. That's too bad we didn't get a hold of you earlier, Chris. We only heard 10% of what you said that time, so you're getting out of range, and I know you're heading north, so it's not going to get better. Paul, WS2N, are you still on frequency? Have you stayed awake this late? I hope you have, because I got a quick question for you. WS2N, K2RIW.
Still here, Dick. Good night. WS2N, how you doing?
Very fine now, Paul. You do want to see the May 2011 issue of Scientific American. On page 72, beautiful illustration of the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. This really world's highest power gamma ray cosmic ray detector that's about to be put up by the space shuttle onto the International Space Station. Beautiful picture showing it. Unfortunately, it's only two pages. I wish it was more, but a very, very nice illustration. And it says it is a $2 billion piece of electronics. Wow. The space shuttle was also $2 billion. I said the Hubble Space Telescope, $2 billion. And it says here that at the time of this writing, they thought it was going to go up on April 19, which I know that that particular shuttle was delayed. What is the current estimation as to when the shuttle is going to take off with this beautiful piece of hardware? And it looks like a very heavy piece of hardware. I'm a little worried. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, that's going up the 29th, let's say. The 29th is Friday. So I'll have to check the time. But, yeah, that's it's going to be attached to one of the truss pieces. Two EVAs to do this. Six-person crew going up. So, one more flight after this. That's going to be it. So, yeah, I'll be looking forward to the installation process. I like watching the EVAs. And you get that on the NASA website. They can watch the TV on a computer. So that's always fun. And let's see. I'm trying to think if there was anything else. This month, it was a pretty lost month. I mean, there was money now being allocated to different private companies for the development of the space program, including not only Progress types of missions where they're going to send cargo up to the space station, but they're going to they're funding now more money for manned development, manned flights. Which will, you know, your next American flights to the space station will be from private companies. I mean, I don't know how many years from now, but it won't be by the government. NASA is funding it. Back to you, Dick.
So you did say that, first of all, the shuttle was supposed to be cut off at the end of 2010. Here we are in 2011, and by congressional requests and a whole lot of other requests, it was extended. April 29th, this coming Friday, is going to be the launch that brings up the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. And you said there's one more launch after that. What piece of hardware is being brought up on that launch, and what's the best guess as to when that launch will take place? Over to you, Paul.
That's a resupply mission. You're just going to bring up a lot of heavy things, ammonia tanks, nitrogen tanks, things that aren't easily brought up without the cargo facility of the space shuttle. Big, heavy stuff that's going to be bolted to the outside of the space station. It's an interesting design. You know, all your main equipment, big operating pieces of pumps and things like that, all operating on the outside of the space station, living quarters are, you know, much more airy, you know, compared to the mirror. I mean, even a lot of your cables and your ammonia piping, and it's all done on the outside of the space station, including storage of gigantic batteries. These things, you know, they're maybe about 2.5 feet wide by 1.5 feet deep. Big batteries, you know, they're all stored outside. So along with all that stuff, they're going to add these gigantic ammonia tanks and oxygen tanks, nitrogen tanks, what have you, and they'll, you know, that's the final mission. So interesting. Too bad they can't extend it, but they're not going to, from what I see.
Paul, do you have a very rough approximation of how many pounds total is International Space Station, question number one? And question number two, right now, what is the expected lifetime? Do we intend to use it for 5 more years? What do you think? Over to you, Paul.
Well, I see that being used for the next 20 years. Initially, it was a 15-year station to be completed. Or I think it was around 2000, 2001 when they decided that it was supposed to be done, you know, from the drawing board, and then it was supposed to last 15 years after that. Of course, here we are in 2011. Officially, it's really done. I mean, this is just an add-on component, this this telescope. So, I mean, everything's done. The cupola is on, you know, eight windows to look out, gigantic looking viewing areas, and at least 10 living compartments, two bathrooms. It,